You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 38th week of the year from September 16th to September 22nd, covering the book of Numbers 15:37 to Numbers 16:12. In Numbers 15:37 and 38, God says to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them that they shall make themselves tzitzis, fringes on the corners of their garments throughout their generations." So from this verse describes a special fringed garment that a Jewish man is supposed to wear. And you may have seen this actually. Sometimes if you see an Orthodox Jewish man, it'll look like he has strings hanging out of his pockets. What this is actually is this is the fringed garment that's described here in the book of Numbers. And it's imagine sort of like an undershirt with four sets of fringes hanging out. And the fringes are actually strings that are tied into a number of knots, very specially designed knots with a certain numerological symbolism in them based on the number of knots and the number of times the strings are wrapped around the knots and so forth. But one of the reasons it's given that for Jewish people to wear tzitzit or tzitzis, some people call them, is they're supposed to remind you of the commandments in the Bible. And in fact, the way the knots are created creates a numerical symbol that represents the number of commandments that are in the Bible. So the idea, though, is that you're supposed to literally wear a reminder of the biblical commandments, of God's commandments for us on your body. And it's not an accident that we're supposed to wrap ourselves up in biblical commandments, so to speak. This comes right after the incident of the spies, where the Israelites reacted with a lot of fear to this negative report that they were going to be unable to conquer the land of Israel, even though God had promised it to them. So this instruction to wear tzitzis comes after it, perhaps as a way to help people remember that God is with them all the time. He's literally wrapped around your body. And for us, as we try to have conscious contact with a higher power, this might be a good reminder. If you can think of the tzitzit, or if you're Jewish, you can wear one. You're wrapped in a divine energy. It's like the holy light of God is encircling you, and maybe this can give you strength. And I think for anybody, though, we can try and imagine that we're cloaked in God's power. We're all wrapped up with the light of God. That's the symbolism of the tzitzis. Now, Numbers 16:1 to 16:3 introduces a new story, an important story in the Bible, the story of Korach. Korach, this is a story of rebellion, okay? And this is what the verses say, Numbers 16:1 to 16:3. Korach, son of Issachar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, separated himself with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, the offspring of Reuben. They stood before Moses with 250 men from the children of Israel, leaders of the assembly, those summoned for meeting, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron, and said to them, "It is too much for you." So Korach and his group, he has three primary co-conspirators, Dathan, Abiram, and own, and 250 other renowned people, men of renown, notable people, rebel against Moses. Now, the reason, I mean, this is, the timing of this is not coincidental, because, you know, God has just ruled that the Israelites are to stay in the wilderness for another 38 years, and that they, the current generation, will not be allowed to enter the promised land. So, in reaction, it seems, Korach is leading a rebellion. He's had it with Moses, and he's talked a bunch of other people into it. And it's curious, but I think helpful for our perspective to understand that Korach is, of course, wrong. He's quite misguided, but he seems to have plenty of people who want to help him topple Moses and Aaron from their heavenly appointed roles. And if we look at his co-conspirators, they're from the tribe of Reuben. The tribe of Reuben, in this, if you remember, each tribe had a specific place where they camped around the tabernacle. The tribe of Reuben camped next to the tribe of Levi, which was Korach's tribe. So this proximity allowed the Reubenites to become influenced by Korach's desire for rebellion. And what we can take away from this, what the commentators observe too, is that problems can come up when otherwise good people associate with those who are evil. You know, a bad neighbor can influence you to behave badly. Certainly in recovery we see this challenge. And, you know, and as the program really encourages us, you know, getting sober has a lot to do with staying away from people who are toxic or triggering, or situations that are bad for you, or your old friends who are still drinking and using, you know, downward companionship and associating with people who are active in addiction is generally known to be a path to disaster for someone in recovery. Now, in some cases, you can't avoid it, but generally speaking, if you want to be sober, you have to hang around with people who are interested in sobriety, even if it's painful to make the change. And the story of Korach is just an example of how people can be influenced by bad ideas from their neighbors and friends. So, continuing with number 16:3, where it says, "They gathered together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, 'It is too much for you, for the entire assembly, all of them are holy, and God is among them. Why do you exalt yourselves over the congregation of God?'" Now, what they're talking about is that God has said that all the children of Israel are holy. This is true. And so Korach is sort of taking this and using it against Moses, saying, "How can you exalt yourself over all of us?" But what Korach seems to have forgotten conveniently is that God specifically chose Moses to be the leader and chose Aaron to be the high priest. But Korach is a demagogue. He's playing to the crowd. He's feeding on everyone's fear and anger after the incident of the spies and the divine punishment that the Israelites will not be allowed to enter the land. So that's sort of the superficial story, but what's really going on, as we might say, looking at the nightly news, what's really going on here? The commentators say that Korach was actually angry that he was not appointed the high priest, and therefore he lashes out against Moses and Aaron. And in some ways, of course, it's very understandable. Korach is angry over perceived rejection, and the anger is so intense that he basically denies the existence of God just to prove his point. Meaning, although they're talking about God, that, you know, but he's saying, essentially, if Moses could be self-appointed, then the word of God is meaningless, because if you accept Moses as your God-given leader, then you accept the existence of God. If you think that Moses appointed himself leader, then somehow you think the word of God doesn't mean anything, or that you know better. So it's perplexing because Korach, this is one of the ways, it's interesting, these little details. How do you know Korach was an important person? The reason you know is that earlier in the Bible, and I don't have the citation handy, but earlier his birth was recorded in the Bible. It's in one of those verses where they describe whose children, who had children. He was so important that his birth was recorded in the Bible. So he was one of the most important people in history. He was a very righteous man, according to the commentary, learned, a great man, a prince of Israel. So how did he fall so far from these heights of holiness? And one answer is that rejection has tremendous negative power. I think we all know this. Nobody likes to be rejected from anything. It can be soul-crushing to be, turned down for a job or dumped by a romantic partner or, apply for something and get turned down. It hurts. It hurts. There's no way to get around it hurting. But the challenge in recovery is to process the rejection in a healthy way. And maybe that means learning to accept that not every situation or relationship that we want was meant to be. And perhaps it's a good thing that it didn't happen, even if it feels horrible in the moment. We need to learn not to lash out, being like Korach, and let our anger over rejection affect our belief in a higher power. Numbers 16:8 to 16:10 says, Moses said to Korach, Hear now, O offspring of Levi, it is not enough for you that the God of Israel has segregated you from the assembly of Israel to draw you near to himself, to perform the service of the tabernacle of God, and to stand before the assembly to minister to them. And he drew you near, and all your brethren, the offspring of Levi, with you, yet you seek the priesthood as well. So this is Moses' rebuke to Korach. So just to understand the sort of the genealogy here, Korach was from a branch of the Levite tribe. Moses was also, and Aaron were also in the Levite tribe, but Aaron and his descendants were separated further from the tribe of Levi to be the priests, to be the high priests. The Levites, in general, were sort of at a slightly lower level, but they also were given very important holy work. So you have to imagine kind of the tribe of Levi was separated from all the other Israelites to serve in the tabernacle, and Aaron, who was a Levite, was chosen to be the high priest. Korach, as part of what they called a Kohathite branch of the Levite family, had a specific role in the tabernacle. He had a specific holy purpose assigned directly from God to serve in the tabernacle. But he was not the high priest. He wasn't the numero uno guy in the tabernacle. And so he, Korach, with his ego, thinks, that should have been me. I should have been the high priest. Okay? And he doesn't appreciate the duty that he's been given by God, this holy role. So he covets the role of high priest. And in this way, he's acting like people, I know them, and you probably know them too, an ungrateful alcoholic. He's been granted a position of great holy responsibility, far closer to the center of spiritual life than is given to the average Israelite. Yet his envy for his cousin, Aaron, is too much for him. It drives him to an act of rebellion that is so intense that it destroys him and threatens the belief system of millions of other people. I mean, if it was just him, it would be bad enough, but he's influencing a lot of other people to think the way he does. And this is the terrible power of dissatisfaction. It can become a spiritual illness in addiction. And the truth is, if you aren't satisfied with what you have, you will never be satisfied with anything that you get. You'll always want more, and you'll always be hungry and angry and resentful about others who have things that you want. It's an endless trap, and it can ruin people. People get destroy themselves over things like this, certainly in spiritual terms. And there's a balance to be struck, because obviously you can be sober and you can want to have more in your life, but there's a healthy way to pursue it and an unhealthy way. And I think that the challenge, and this isn't easy, of course, the challenge is to appreciate what you have and understand that you can work for more, but be willing to accept what God gives you. And I think that this comes up a little bit sometimes in recovery. People say, well, I'm praying for more money, or I'm praying for a new job, or I'm praying for a new romantic relationship, or whatever it is. And I think it's helpful to understand that sometimes when you pray to God, the answer that God gives you back is no. And there's many reasons for this, right? We don't know, but maybe God doesn't think you're ready for that new job or new car or new relationship yet. Maybe you need to work on yourself or just wait a little longer. So, you know, the trick is to know how to handle these situations that are frustrating. Number 16:12 reads, Moses sent for to summon Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, we shall not go up. So Moses wants to appeal to the leaders of the rebellion. He wants to have a word with these co-conspirators and try and talk them, you know, off the ledge of their disastrous scheme, but they say no. Now, it's an interesting play on words here. They say, we shall not go up, meaning somehow will not, what they literally mean is, we will not go up to see Moses. But they're actually accidentally making a prophetic statement, because the phrase to go up also refers to going up to the land of Israel. And so what they're actually saying is true. They will not go up to the land of Israel. They are accidentally predicting their real fate, because when the punishment comes, they'll be cast into a pit. They will not go up, they will go down. And they will not be allowed to live to go up into the land of Israel. So their arrogant posturing actually foretells their fate. They're too caught up in the momentum of their own egos to repent. And, you know, this is a familiar tale for anyone who's known a serious addict. These two men, Dathan and Abiram, are like these angry, self-destructive drunks who decline all help and say, you know, I'll show everybody. You know, I know what's right and everyone else is wrong. And everyone's just watching like, boy, this is a disaster and there's nothing we can do to stop it. But they're actually, you know, predicting their own faith. And people say, I'll take care of myself. Well, they end up taking care of themselves in a negative way. So continuing on with this Numbers 16:12, there's an observation you might make if you're reading it carefully, which is what happened to the third co-conspirator. Originally there were three, Dathan, Abiram, and On. What happened to On? So according to the commentators, On's wife talked him out of continuing to be involved in this rebellion. She said to him, according to the Talmud, what have you to gain from this folly? Even if Korach wins, he will be priest, and you will be subservient to him as you are now to Moses and Aaron. And she's saying to him, what's in this for you? Nothing. You're the second banana now, and you'll be the second banana then. And the difference is that you're risking your life now for this. Now, I think Own was lucky to be married to a woman who cared enough to step up and tell her husband he was wrong. Now maybe you're thinking, that's not a big deal. Every woman tells her husband that he's wrong. But this took some courage on her part. And he had enough sense to listen to her. That's another, so it's really two amazing things. And, you know, I think we all live through this in some way in our lives, whether you're married or not, whether it's a friend or a partner or whatever. When we're using, we often rebuff attempts by those who love us, who want us to get help. That's such a classic situation, you know. Someone's in trouble with addiction, someone who really cares about them tries to help and gets told to butt out, or worse. But maybe we can learn to be like Own. This happens in recovery too, by the way. There's plenty of people who are sober but need more help in sobriety, maybe psychologically or whatever. And they still, and they're, you don't have to be an active drunk to be like this, to say, oh, I don't need your help. You can certainly be this way in recovery. We should be like Owen, who's able to listen and be brought back from the brink of disaster. What's also interesting about Owen's wife is the story is told in the commentary that she took action to prevent the conspirators from luring Owen back into their ranks. She, Abiram and Dasan came to see him, and she would not let them into the tent. So she's a great example of thought and action in combination. She didn't just think what she had to do, she did it, and she took active steps to prevent the addict prevent Owen from being in touch with his co-conspirators. And maybe that can inspire us, if we're working with people in addiction, take active steps to keep them from falling into the wrong kind of company. And I certainly know, I mean, I have friends who make 12-step calls, and they get in the car and they go down to these weird motels and pull people out of rooms and take action, you know, to get people away from danger. And just continuing on with this, Numbers 16:12, Moses sent for to summon Dasan and Aviram, sons of Eliab, but they said, we shall not go up. We now know why Owen, son of Peleth, is not with the conspiracy any longer. His wife took risks to protect her husband and talk him out of participating in the plot. Now, in contrast, according to the commentary, we have the wife of Korach. Korach's wife was an enabler. She was his biggest fan, and she helped him. She actually helped him figure out ways to ridicule Moses. And what the commentary says, it's a little bit technical, but it's kind of interesting, is that the commandment to have the tzitzis that we started the podcast with also had it, one of the commandments that comes with it is that one of the threads, one of the fringes, is supposed to be dyed blue. In fact, you'll see this too. Sometimes if you see a Jewish man wearing tzitzit, sometimes one of the threads is dyed blue. Okay? So what Korach's wife did is she made him a tzitzis. It was all blue. Totally blue tzitzis. So Korach went up to Moses wearing this blue fringed garment and said, hey, Moses, does this also need a blue thread? So he was mocking Moses and ridiculing him. And the problem here is that Korach is really ridiculing God. Because this commandment, what he's saying basically is that Moses just made this up. This idea you have a blue thread. He's really saying this is all fake. Moses said a blue thread, well, I'll show him a blue thread, right? And there's a lot of things going on here that are helpful to us. One is a tremendous negative power of mockery. I think a lot of times in sort of popular culture, we're told to dismiss mockery as being not serious. You know, it's whatever, sticks and stones. But the truth is that mockery is very powerful and very toxic. And you have to be suspicious of it and careful not to get sucked into its power. It can really subvert your spiritual growth. And because it can make anything look stupid or irrelevant, but it doesn't accomplish very much beyond that. It's a destructive force. And I think that this idea that Korach's wife is the driver of this, she's enabling him, she's encouraging him, is she's a tremendous negative role model for people in recovery. Because unfortunately, there are always people we can find, you know, romantic partners, friends, who will support us in our addiction. And the Big Book talks about this too. You know, they talk about the woman who understands. That's a problem, because there's always someone who'll understand your great need to be a drunk, you know, and support you in that until you die from it, you know. Because so it's a challenge. I think it's a double challenge. We need to find people who are not like that, and we have to be not like that to other people. It's very easy to be an enabler, either deliberately or accidentally, or you know, through weakness, or you know, just being exhausted from people, letting them do stuff. But we need to steer clear of people like this, and we have to avoid being like this. It will not be good for our recovery.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com